So we're going to be talking about joyous effort. And as I mentioned last night, using Shantideva's text, A Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, specifically Chapter 7, which is entitled Joyous Effort. And here he's talking about joyous effort in a spiritual context. Yeah, not joyous effort in, you know, getting the most out of your stocks, but joyous effort in, you know, practicing the path. So I want to just take a few minutes and set the environment within which this joyous effort occurs, okay? So begins by asking, what is the I? When I say I don't mean this one. I mean the I, the self, the person. You know, who am I? Which is a big question. Okay, what we call I, what we label I, depends on a body and a mind. Right? We have a body, we have mind or consciousness. When these two are associated, we say the person is alive. At the time of death, the continuity of the mind continues, the continuity of the body continues, but they're not associated anymore. So that's what we call death. The continuity of the body, you know, because the body is physical, material in nature. Yeah, it's caught previous causes, the sperm and the egg, you know, made out of the different elements. The continuity of the body, also something material. Yeah, it either becomes ashes if you cremate it, it becomes the worm's lunch if you bury it. You know, its continuity is something physical. The consciousness or the mind, on the other hand, is not physical. Yeah, its nature is clarity and awareness. Clarity meaning that it is has the ability to reflect objects and that it's not something material. And awareness in the sense that it can engage with objects. It can cognize objects. Okay, so, you know, what the continuity of the consciousness, you know, being an immaterial thing, was also something immaterial, the previous moment of mind. And, you know, like this moment of mind depends on previous moment of mind, which arose from the previous moment of mind, you know, back to the time of conception. Yeah, then where did that first moment of consciousness come from? Not the stork, yeah, but we say from the consciousness of the previous life. Or actually, we say more the consciousness of the intermediate stage being and then the consciousness of the previous life. In the same way, in the future, when we die and the body and mind are no longer associated, you still have that continuity of clarity and awareness. And so the mind stream continues. Yeah, a mind stream that is still ignorant, that doesn't know the nature of reality, then gets reborn according to the actions it's done in the past. Actions means karma. Okay? So it's not according to the sum total of all of our karma, but rather we've done many different actions. So we've planted many different seeds in the mind stream, and different seeds will ripen and mature at different times, yeah, according to the conditions that happen to be present. So that influences what we are reborn as. As I said, when the mind is, you know, doesn't understand the nature of reality, yeah, then what happens is we generate a lot of attachment to the self and to things that belong to the self. We have a lot of anger when things interfere with our happiness, with ourself or our belongings or what we want. And, and then sometimes we're totally ignorant about what is virtuous and what is not virtuous. So these three, the clinging attachment, anger, and confusion or ignorance, are called the three poisonous attitudes. There's many other kind of mental defilements. But these, you know, cause us to do different kinds of unwholesome or non-virtuous actions. We also have many virtuous mental factors. Yeah, they still operate under the influence of ignorance, of not knowing the nature of reality. But they're virtuous mental factors like generosity, ethical conduct, compassion, love, and so on. So those put good karmic seeds in our mind that will influence our future rebirths and also what happens to us in our different rebirths, in a good way. So when the Buddhist whole view of, the situation we're in right now is called cyclic existence, or the Sanskrit word is samsara. And what that means is it means taking a body and mind under the influence of ignorance. Yeah, so repeatedly taking a body and mind under the influence of ignorance. Yeah. And because there's ignorance, we don't really have a lot of control. We are all, most of us, I would say, are control freaks. Yeah? Any of you like to control things? Yeah? Yeah? We want to control everything and make it exactly the way we want to. And yet we're constantly frustrated because we can't. Yeah? We try and control the external environment. You know, California can't make rain happen. Yeah, all the people here, I want to control the weather and make it rain tomorrow. You know, we can't make it rain tomorrow. Not today, we certainly can't. Yeah, we want to control the people that we live with. It'd be nice to control the government a little bit, wouldn't it? Yeah. And because you'd be able to control the Ebola epidemic, to control ISIS, to control the Republicans and the Democrats and the Congress. Wouldn't it be nice to control the Congress and make them function well? Yeah? Make them do something that actually is beneficial instead of squabble. Wouldn't that be nice? But, we can't control all those people. Yeah. And we just got done with a short breathing meditation. Can you control your mind? Yeah. Anybody who didn't get distracted during that meditation? Yeah. Even our own mind we can't control. Can you control your body? Well, yeah, you can have some control over when you eat, when you don't eat, But can you stop yourself from aging? Yeah. Can you control getting sick? Can you make it so you don't die? Yeah. Walt Disney froze his whole body, so that they can revive him later when science figures out a way to do it. It's not going to work. Yeah, sorry, Walt, this one doesn't work. You can imagine all you want, but it's not going to happen. So, why? Because the consciousness is left already. It's gone. So, this ignorance is a big problem in our own, in our mind, because it, Yeah, even when we do something wholesome, it's still contaminated because we don't see the nature of reality. And then, you know, when we do something unwholesome, then it's even worse because we're harming others. And when we harm others, we also harm ourselves by putting those destructive seeds in our own mental continuum. So we want to get out of this situation that we're in. And the Buddha described the path that leads us out of the situation. A path, although we use the word path like it's, you know, something you walk on, actually a path is a consciousness. Yeah. So practicing the path or following the path means changing our mind, transforming our mind. Yeah. Understanding what reality is so that we can overcome the ignorance. Learning the antidotes to attachment, anger, ignorance, jealousy, pride. Yeah. All these kinds of mental factors that impede our being of benefit to ourselves and others. So we want to overcome those. We need to learn the path. Yeah. One way, sometimes we use the word dharma to describe the path. Sometimes the word dharma means the teachings that describe the path. Sometimes dharma means the path itself and the result of the path. We look at the Buddha as the one who taught the dharma. And the Sangha, those who have realizations of the path, as the ones who help us. Yeah, the monastic community, not one person, but a community of four more fully ordained people, also is called the Sangha. So we look at the Buddha as like the doctor. You know, well, first of all, we start out, we're the patients. Yeah. If we're going to do a spiritual path, the first thing we have to do is admit that we need help. Yeah. If we don't need help, if our life is hunky-dory, if we're perfectly fine, wonderful, charming people, then we certainly don't need a spiritual path. So we have to start off saying, I have difficulties. I have confusion. My mind gets stuck on things and can't let go. Yeah, I hold on to grudges. Yeah. If I'm talking about you, don't worry. It's not just about you. It's about me and everybody in here. Okay, so don't go thinking, oh, I'm the only one who has these problems. We all have them. Okay, so we have, you know, these difficulties, and so we're like a sick person in that way, yeah. So we go to the Buddha, who's like the doctor, who diagnoses and says, oh, you have problems? Yeah, that's because you're suffering from ignorance, anger, and attachment. Here's the medicine of the Dharma. Okay, so the medicine is how to transform our minds. So then we have to practice the Dharma. We have to take the medicine. Getting a prescription from a doctor, putting the prescription on your nightstand, does that make you well? No. Okay. You can have a stack of prescriptions. You can even go to the pharmacy and get the medicine and put the medicine on your nightstand. Does that make you well? No, you have to take the medicine, don't you? Yeah. And so sometimes we need help taking the medicine. When I was a little kid, I couldn't swallow pills. I don't know about you. Did you have trouble swallowing pills when you were a kid? And, you know, so mom had to smash it and mix it in with applesauce and add some extra sugars, I would take it. Yeah. And then remind you me to take it. So the Sangha is like that. The Sangha is our support system who helps us practice the teachings to take the medicine of the Dharma and apply it to our mind. Yeah. And then when we do that in a consistent way, we start to recover. We get better. Yeah. But if you just take the medicine one day and not the next day, you know, it doesn't work, does it? This happens in India a lot, you know, where people have TB. So you give them TB medicine, they feel better, they stop the medicine, and then the TB gets worse, actually. So you have to take the full course of the medicine, you know, in order to make sure that you recover and stay recovered. So, and you have to take it, you know, in the way the doctor prescribed it in order for it to work properly. So in the same way, you know, we want to practice as the Buddha described so that the path will really work in our mind in a proper way. So the Buddha did not create the path. The Buddha did not create cyclic existence. The Buddha is not a creator, okay? The Buddha simply described and explained what he was able to do himself, what he discovered, okay? So the Buddha, we're not taking out the idea of a creator God and putting, you know, just changing it from a guy with a white hair and a long beard into a Buddha, you know, looking like a Buddha. That's not what we're doing. Yeah, the idea of God, the idea of Buddha, completely different. Yeah, there's some crossovers, of course. There's some, you know, similarities, but don't confuse Buddha with God. Yeah, because God is seen as a creator, and Buddha did not create. Yeah, Buddha simply described. There's some difficulties with accepting the notion of a creator God. Yeah, I don't know about you, but as a kid, I had some problems with that. Because I said, why, if God is kind, why did God create so much suffering? Yeah, and I was told that you don't ask that question. I mean, they never told me not to ask that question, but that was the definite vibe. And when I did ask it, the answer was, well, God wanted us to learn from our suffering. And I said, then why didn't he create us smart to start with? Yeah, if he's an all-powerful creator, why didn't he create us smart? So I couldn't get answers that actually made sense to me. Huh? So it was for me, you know, while the notion of God helps many people and it's good for them, for me it certainly didn't work. Yeah, and so the Buddhist description of cause and effect, yeah, things happening dependent on causes, there being no ultimate beginning cause. Yeah, this actually made a lot of sense to me. Because finding an ultimate beginning cause, it's rather difficult, isn't it? Yeah, I don't think a black hole is a beginning cause. Because before the black hole, something else had to exist. Okay. As a kid, I used to lie out. These are in the days when there were clear skies in Southern California, where I grew up. And I looked out and I thought, where's the end of the universe? Yeah. Did you ever do that as a kid? Where's the end of the universe? And I thought, is there a brick wall somewhere? And I said, there can't be a brick wall Because if you have a brick wall, there's something on the other side, which means the wall isn't the end. And so it was just like infinity, you know? It just went on. How could you talk about an end of space? I mean, what's going to circumscribe the end of space? And so similarly, you know, when we talk about our existence in samsara, or our ignorance that's fueling this existence in samsara, the ignorance is also beginningless. Yeah, why are we ignorant today? Our ignorance today arose from our ignorance yesterday, arose from the ignorance the day before and the day before and the day before. And there was no ultimate beginning to it. Because if you say there was a beginning to ignorance, then what made us become ignorant? Yeah. Now, do you think eating an apple, you know, is that the cause of ignorance? And do you think ignorance is passed down through our genes? Yeah. Ignorance is a consciousness. It's not passed down through our genes. So it's this whole idea mentally also, when we talk about the clear and aware nature of the mind, that there was no beginning to the continuity of the mind. There was no beginning to ignorance, anger, and attachment. Nobody made us ignorant. Yeah. And it's actually useless to try and find a first moment, because that's like trying to find the end of the number line. Remember in math class? Yeah. You have plus 1, 2, 3, 4, infinity that direction. Minus 1, 2, 3, 4, infinity in that direction. Are you going to find the end of the number line? If you go to your math teacher and say, there's got to be an end, what's your math teacher going to say? You can think that way, but good luck finding it. Yeah, so it's the same way here. Yeah. Now, the thing with ignorance is, although there's no beginning, there is an end. Okay? Because ignorance misapprehends the nature of reality. Yeah. Ignorance is an erroneous mind state. It's a a wrong, incorrect mind state, because it sees things in the way that is opposite from how they exist. Okay? It's kind of like if you were born with sunglasses and all you saw were things that were dark. Things are not dark, are they? But when you're born with sunglasses, you see them that way. And because you've always seen them that way, you don't even realize that that's not the way they exist. In fact, you never question it, because you've always had sunglasses on. Why would you question it? You don't know any better. So it's kind of like us, you know, we misapprehend the nature of reality and then don't even realize that we're misapprehending it. We think that the way we see things is actually the way they exist, okay? So when we look at things, we think they have an essence, a nature from their own side. You know, that is a flower from its own side, and that's a clock. You know, it has a nature of being a clock. And I'm me. You know, there's me here, a real person. So everything seems very real to us, very independent, you know, as if it existed under its own power or had its own, you know, essence, that you could find that essence. Yeah. So it's like that question, you know, who am I? And we're trying to find one thing that is me. Did you ever go through that? You know, when you're little, wondering, who am I? And trying to figure out who I was. And we talk about who I am, you know, and that's when we create this identity that I talked about yesterday. I'm this career, I'm this gender, I'm this, you know, socioeconomic class, I'm this, 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 this. We create that identity. But is that who we really are? Yeah? Is that who we really are? Yeah? For example, we say, I'm American. Yeah? Anybody here is not American? You have any? What are you?
German.
German, okay. Any Mexicans, Canadians? Okay. So, excuse me if I use the example of American. So we say, I'm American. Yeah? What makes you American? What makes you American? Yeah, you feel, I'm American. What is American? Is your body American? Is your mind American? Do you have an American body? Yeah? Do you have an American mind? What makes you American? I mean, the only thing that makes us American or German or Mexican or Canadian or Swahili is our passport. And what's a passport? You have your American passport. That makes me American. Yeah, that means I go in a certain line when I arrive at the border. Okay, what's a passport? Paper and ink. Paper and ink. It's interesting, isn't it, when you really look? Yeah. Makes you ask questions, yeah. What does it mean to be American? I'm fighting for America. What is, in the world does that mean? That we're all fighting for our passports? I don't think so. Yeah. So somehow we have this idea that there's something when we don't analyze, when we don't analyze, when we don't question, there's something that is American. Or there's something that is America. Yeah. So if I ask you, what is America? What are you going to point to? Here, this is America. So if I pull up a handful of dirt and I hold the dirt in my hand, is this America? Imagine some dirt in my hand. Yeah, handful of dirt. Is this America? This dirt? What happens if I throw this dirt over the border? Does it become Canadian? Canada now? Huh? So what is America? Well, it's this land, you know, with these certain borders. Who made the borders? Yeah. Belongs to us. Who in the world is us? Who owns America? Yeah, so when you start to question, I'm just using this as an example, but when you start to question, then it makes you really think, well, I have some ideas about America and American, but what do they really mean? Yeah, what does it really mean? Okay? So, you know, our nationality is just one part of our identity. But what does it mean? Or you say, I'm a woman, I'm a man. What does that mean? Yeah, is your mind male? Is your mind female? Yeah, on what basis do we say male or female? That's even more confusing these days. Yeah? But on what basis do we say male and female when we get down to it? You know, it's usually on the basis of, you know, the arrangement of atoms and molecules. That's all. Okay. So what I'm getting at here is that things look like they have some kind of essence in and of themselves, that they don't. And because they appear that way, and because we believe them to exist that way, because we believe there's a real independent me, then I become the most important thing in the world. Because there's a real me. And everything, you know, my happiness becomes the most important. My suffering becomes the most important. Things that belong to me are really important. Yeah? And so everything gets totally exaggerated. Yeah? As soon as we put the label my on something, our whole understanding of what that thing is changes. Yeah, have you noticed that? Yeah? My, one little syllable. Yeah. As soon as we put the word my on something, yeah, this is my cup. It is not your cup. You cannot use it. My cup is beautiful. Do you see my cup? Isn't it beautiful? It's much nicer than your cup. But if your cup is nicer, then I'm jealous because your cup is nicer than my cup. So I want to destroy your cup, or I want to take it and give you my cup because I want the best cup. And if you get in the way of me enjoying my cup, you're in for big trouble. If you break my cup, if you steal my cup, if you insult my cup, yeah, I'm going to get really mad and let you know it. And if you don't apologize, I'm not going to speak to you for the rest of my life. Because this is my cup, the best cup. Right? Okay? It looks ridiculous when you think, when you put it on a cup, doesn't it? Put the my on a person. This is my husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter, friend, employer, employee, colleague. My. What happens when you put the word my on a person, on another person? Does your view of them change when you put the word my on? How does it change? Yeah. We put on a whole lot of expectations, don't we? How many of you have kids? A lot of you. Okay. If your kid flunks their spelling test, this is a big deal, isn't it? Yeah? First grade, flunked their spelling test. Yeah? Didn't know how to spell cat. Spelled it K-A-T. Yeah? Because it's Kit Kat. You know the candy? Kit Kat. So, spell cat, K-A-T. Flunked their spelling test. They're not going to get into college. Yeah. I have a kid that just, you know, can't spell. Well, maybe they can because there's spell check now. But maybe my kid doesn't know how to use spell check wisely. Not going to get into college. Oh, no, they're going to be living with me when they're 40. Well, I'm still living with mom and dad, and I'm 40. You know, so they're still going to, their life is going to be a disaster. They're not going to have a career. They're not going to make any money. They're going to be out on the streets because they flunked first grade spelling test. Yeah, if it's your kid and your kid doesn't, you know, something like that, it's a big thing, isn't it? If your neighbor's kid flunks their spelling test in first grade, is it a big thing? Who cares? Who cares? You know, it's like you tell your neighbor, just relax, you know. They'll learn to spell. It's okay, don't worry. But if it's your kid, disaster. Just because the word my was put on that kid. Now you may say, oh, but there's something more than my. That kid has my genes, my blood. So you're your genes? Yeah? If you put your genes out there, you know, when they do samples of genes, you know, gene testing, put them out there, do you say that's me? My genes look better than anybody else's. Yeah, they're so colorful. They're so be nicer than your genes. You know, are your genes you? Anyway, are our genes, do our genes even belong to us? Where do our genes come from? Mom and dad. Grandmas and grandpas. Great-grandparents. Our genes don't even really belong to us. So what do you mean that kid is mine because we have the same genes? The genes don't belong to me. How can the kid belong to me? Mine. Yeah? That doesn't mean you don't like your kid or you don't love your kid or you mistreat your kid. I'm not saying that. Yeah? But just this pile of expectations we put on anybody that we call my or mine. Yeah? It's true, isn't it? Yeah? You fall in love with somebody. Yeah? They're mine. What does that mean? It means they're supposed to meet every need I have. They're supposed to encourage me when I want to be encouraged. They're supposed to be in a goofy mood when I'm in a goofy mood. They're supposed to be in a serious mood when I'm in a serious mood. Yeah, they're supposed to fulfill all my needs and be whatever I want them to be whenever I want them to be that. Right? That's included in the contract. Yeah, that's what the words I love you mean. It means you're going to be all these things for me. Okay, because you're mine. You're my boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever it is. Therefore, and a pile of expectations. What happens when you put these expectations on the people you care about? What happens when they put their expectations on you? You know? And let's suppose people were really frank before they got married, you know, or even moved in, and somebody said to you, I expect you to meet all my needs, to be what I want you to be when you I want you to be it, to always love me, never get angry at me, always see me as perfect, never forget my birthday or our anniversary. You know, be everything I want you to be, and somebody said that to you, what would you say? Yeah, bye. I can't do that. I can't do that. I can't be everything you want me to be. And yet, what do we expect of them? For them to be everything we want them to be. And that's what we expect of our parents. Yeah? Oh, my, you know, now we blame our parents for everything that's wrong with us. I think that's totally unfair. Yeah? I mean, we have this image of our parents. It's like we never matured from childhood, you know, because there's this stage of childhood where mom and dad are, you know, you idolize mom and dad. But, you know, when you grow up, you're supposed to get over that and realize that they're human beings. And we never get over it, and we look at mom and dad and blame them for all of our problems. Why am I so screwed up? You did this and this and this, and you didn't do this and this and this. You know? I mean, come on. Really? What does it mean to be a perfect parent? Especially all of you who are trying to be perfect parents. Yeah? Who make the vow never to say to your kids what your parents said to you. And then those words come right out of your mouth when you're mad, don't they? The same thing your parents said, don't they? Hello? True or not true? One or two people are nodding in agreement. Yeah. The things you said, when you were little, that you hated when your parents said to you, and you said, I will never say that to my child. Then you get mad. Same words, you know? So, yeah? So, how did I get off on that? Anyway, yeah, this whole idea of expectations and attachment that comes simply based on the word my and everything we impute on anything we put the word my on. Yeah? And how, you know, we really believe that our expectations are reasonable and accurate because that's who that person is and that's what they should be and that's what was our agreement. Yeah? And then we feel really betrayed when they're not like that. Is the problem them, or is the problem our expectation, our wrong views? Yeah, this is, you know, a question that we need to ask ourselves. Okay, so ignorance is the source of all of this because it imputes things onto it imputes a mode of existence. It imputes, you know, good qualities, bad qualities, you know. And then we believe all of the stuff that we have projected and imputed. And this is a big, you know, the source of our problems, you know. It's the source of ignorance, anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, lack of integrity, you know, all these kinds of things. And so this we have to overcome this ignorance. The good news is, okay, the Buddhist version of the good news is that actually ignorance can be overcome because it is erroneous. Yeah, if things existed the way the ignorant mind perceived as having their own inherent nature, then it would be impossible to eliminate ignorance because eliminate ignorance would be a correct view. But because it misapprehends things, yeah, when we generate the wisdom that realizes this misapprehension, then that wisdom can overcome the ignorance. And then that, in turn, overcomes all these other disturbing emotions, which stops the creation of karma Yeah, polluted karma, polluted by ignorance, which stops this cycle of existence. Okay. So when we talk about nirvana, that's what we're aiming for. Yeah. When we talk about full awakening, we're talking about taking nirvana up a step and saying not just eliminating the causes, you know, of my own suffering and being content with that, but realizing that everybody else is exactly like me. Yeah, that there's really no difference amongst us. And so working for my own liberation, my own nirvana, something is not totally right with that. It's a little bit self-centered, a lot self-centered. Yeah. And so we aspire for full awakening so that we can be of the greatest benefit to all living beings. And it's with that motivation that we then practice the path. Okay? Isn't my cup. Actually, it's not my cup. It's Vajrapani's cup. Maybe they'll give it to me. Maybe if I could drop enough hints, they'll give me this cup. Because if I have this cup, I will be happy. Yeah. Isn't that the way we see different things, possessions? If I only had this, I would be happy. Yeah. So it's a useful cup. Actually, I don't like the color so well. Okay. So that's the background scenario within which we're going to talk about joyous effort. Okay? So it's the joyous effort to practice the Dharma to help us overcome our mental afflictions, to help us cultivate our beautiful human potential and all the good seeds we have in our minds, to help us cultivate our good qualities, love, compassion, generosity, fortitude, and so on. Okay? So that's the kind of joyous effort that we're going to be talking about. Let me pause here and see if you have any questions so far. Yeah.
So if Maya is the cause for everything, so should I see everyone and everything who's mine as not mine, just somebody?
Okay. So if labeling something mine causes a lot of problems, then do I just not call things mine? Yeah. It isn't the labeling of things as mine that's the problem. It's our attachment to the label and the projections we put on that label, okay? Because in a conventionally existent world, you know, it is okay to say, these are my glasses, yeah? I mean, it's convenient to say, these are my glasses in that sense. For example, if I forget them and I ask somebody, you know, who's going in that direction, please get my glasses, then they know which ones are my glasses. If I say, please get the glasses, who knows what they'll bring me? Okay? So labeling mine, it can be useful. Yeah, as a mode of communicating. But it's when we impute more to the word mine than it actually is worth that we get into trouble. Okay? So what I was saying, like about with relationships, with people, yeah, your mine means, and then we have this whole list of expectations. It's those expectations that, and our notion that that those expectations should never, ever, ever be violated. Yeah, that causes us the problem. Okay? There is reason for certain expectations. You know, when you came here for the weekend, you expected me to do something. Yeah, when I came here, I expected you to do something. Those kind of expectations are appropriate in terms of the context of what we're doing. But we're creating that context. We're creating those expectations, you know? And if we have reasonable expectations, it makes some sense. Otherwise, we all arrive here and then we say, now what do we do? Yeah? But we didn't all get here and stand downstairs and say, okay, what do we do? Because we had in mind a notion, oh, I'm attending the course, you know, I'm leading the course. And so there's different responsibilities that come with that. So as long as that functions in a conventional way and we aren't attached to those things, it's okay. But for example, if, let's say, you expect, because I'm leading the course, if you expect that you should understand that I'm responsible for making sure that you understand everything, that's not a reasonable expectation, because I can't make you understand anything. Yeah? So if you think, oh, she's leading the course, she'll make me understand everything, that's unreasonable, and you'll be very unhappy at the end of the course, because you'll blame all your not understanding on me. Okay. Whereas I don't expect you to understand everything the first time you hear it. And I don't see my job as, you know, that you're to make you understand anything, because I can't. And I don't expect you to understand everything. Okay? So, you know, it's a thing of having reasonable expectations and also knowing that even reasonable expectations aren't always upheld. Yeah. Okay. For example, you know, we expect people to be on time to appointments. Yeah. We have that expectation. It's reasonable in one way, you know, because we all try and arrive on time. But in another way, is it reasonable to really expect that every time people will be on time? Is that reasonable? No. Yeah, because things happen and people get held up and there's traffic or they forget or things happen on the way or who knows what's going on. Okay? So expecting people always to be on time is unreasonable. Yeah. Expecting people to be on time and sometimes not be on time, that's more reasonable, isn't it? Then we don't get so mad when they're late. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Okay. But that's a good question, yeah? How do we relate to things that are mine without, you know, getting so attached? It's like, you know, we all have our shoes outside. If I say, are you attached to your shoes? You say, those beat up old things? No, I'm not attached to those beat up old things. But if you go out there and your shoes aren't there, then what? Yeah, who took my shoes? Those are my shoes. I need my shoes because I don't want to walk barefoot from here to there. You know? So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, sometimes we think, oh, I'm not attached to that, even I call them mine. But then in a you know, the situation changes slightly. I'm very attached to that. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that we can get rid of ignorance.
Yeah.
Or end ignorance, yeah. Can you maybe elaborate if we can end something? Well, where does it start? Because if we can end, there has to be a start.
Why does there have to be a start if it has an end?
Well, same way, you cannot, if it's infinity on one side, there's going to be infinity on the other side.
Not always, okay? With some things, like with the continuity of clarity and awareness, with the mind, there's infinity before, there's infinity afterwards, because there's nothing that can intervene and stop the continuity of clarity and awareness. There's nothing that can cut it off. But ignorance, there is something that can cut it off, and that's wisdom, because wisdom sees that what ignorance apprehends is wrong. When wisdom sees that and the mind becomes very, very familiar with that, then the ignorance can no longer arise because it's a wrong conception and the mind is seeing things as they actually are.
Is that what happened originally with clarity?
No, the clarity is just the mind's ability to reflect objects. There's nothing that can come in and cut that off that can be an antidote to it.
So why was it cut off at one point by ignorance?
Oh, no, the clarity of the mind is still here. It hasn't been cut off. Yeah, it's just that it is covered by ignorance. Yeah, no, the clarity of the mind is still here. It's like we often use the... I'm saying that as a very general statement without getting into all the details of what clarity of the mind means, because then it gets very complicated, you know, saying that, okay? But, yeah, we can maybe say the pure nature of the mind has been there and continues to be there, and the ignorance covers that, okay? So it's like the clouds and the sky. The sky is still there even when the clouds are in it. Okay?
I have a 17-year-old.
Good luck.
Thank you. We're almost through the hardest part, and he has put so many expectations on us and blamed us for everything. And from everybody else around us, we are exemplary parents. He's said he was a monk at two. Been learning from him, giving him lots of credence for what he knows intuitively. But then he went through puberty, and I didn't know having a child at late in life would mean puberty and menopause at the same time. Why didn't somebody tell me that? So there's lots of things floating around that are hormonal. I keep trying to not succumb to his ignorance. Any things you can say about when people project their expectations on you and you still reflect love and you still reflect love and you still reflect love and you know it's going to change at some point and little glimmers happen, but then it goes back and it slides and then you still give love. Anything that you... That's why I'm here.
Okay. Anybody else have the same problem as she does? Anybody else have teenagers? Yeah? Okay, now, what were you like as a teenager? Anybody acting like her, anybody act like her son? Yeah?
Actually, I did not.
Oh.
So that's really hard for me.
Okay.
My mother is talking to my son and saying, your mom wasn't like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, well, you said you were like your son. What would you advise? What would have worked for you?
Not much. Time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's often not much. Yeah. Actually, I think the wise thing to do is when your kids are young, help them create good relationships with other adults so that when they hit puberty and start blaming you for everything and think that everything you say is wrong, there's other adults that they trust who can at least give them some guidance that they'll listen to. Yeah? Because often when you're the parent, yeah, you're not the person who can help them with their problem with their parents. Yeah? Because your parent, when you're going through, especially in Western countries, when we start differentiating ourselves, because we bring kids up here very differently. In Asia, it's very different. Kids do not go through puberty in the same way in Asia. Yeah, because they're brought up with a different notion of self. Yeah, they're brought up with a notion of, yeah, I am part of a family, and I am responsible for this family, and I reflect this family, you know? And we're, in Western cultures, we're brought up with, I am an individual, and I have to be unique in a conforming way. Yeah. Yeah. It's totally crazy making our culture. We want to be unique, but you can't be too unique. You have to be unique in the same way everybody else is being unique. Right? Yeah. So this continues through adulthood. But, you know, often you just have to be extremely stable, yeah, patient. And I think the key is not to take it personally. Yeah? Yeah? You don't have to take it personally. They say what they say. And, you know, you can let them know that what they say, how it affects you. Or, you know, you can try just reflecting to them what you're hearing them say. Yeah? Seems to me that you're really angry because, yeah, you need autonomy. Is that right? Yes, I need autonomy. Stop breathing down my back. Yeah, I understand you need autonomy. You want to make it. You want to be able to make your own decisions, don't you? Yes. I'm 16. No, 17. Yeah. I know everything. But I knew everything when I was 17 too. Didn't you know everything when you were 17? I was almost omniscient at 17. That was the high point, you know, my closest time ever. And it was after that that I started to discover how dumb I was. And it's also, you know what another interesting thing is how your parents get smarter as you get older. Have you noticed that? It's really strange, isn't it? You thought your parents were so dumb, but they actually grow up and get smarter as they get older, as you get older. Yeah. Amazing how that happens. Yeah? So it's just a natural occurrence. Yeah? But sometimes, you know, reflecting back what you're hearing them say can help them understand that you, at least you understand what the issues are for them. Yeah. Oh, you want autonomy. You want to be able to make your own decisions. Yeah. But you don't add the part, but you also want me to be here and emotionally support you when you need it. And you also want me to pay the bills. You know, you don't mention that part. Just, you know, try and, you know, help them, you know, show them that, you know, that you understand just by reflecting back without making any judgments. Not, not, I understand you want to be autonomous, and you really think you can be. No. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So, Shantideva. 10 minutes left. Okay. Okay, if we look at verse 1, okay, or, yeah. So, the verse 1 says, with patience. Here they translated this one word, zopa, as patience. I like to call it fortitude. I think fortitude is a better translation because it means making your mind strong. It means able to endure suffering, able to endure blame or criticism or pain or difficulties. Yeah. So I like the word fortitude better because to me, patience doesn't indicate inner strength, and I think fortitude does. You know, because when you're practicing the path, you have to have a lot of inner strength. Yeah, you can't be a wimp. People sometimes think, oh, bodhisattvas are so compassionate, you know, but compassion means you're a wimp. Compassion does not mean you're a wimp. Yeah. You have to be really strong to have compassion. So it says, with fortitude, I should undertake joyous effort. Enlightenment, I also call that awakening. Awakening will dwell in those who strive. Just as there is no movement without wind, so merit does not occur without joyous effort. Okay? So it begins, you know, it says, I should undertake joyous effort. So the question comes up, what is joyous effort? Okay? Joyous effort is taking delight in virtue. Okay, that's the definition of it. Taking delight in virtue, taking delight in doing, in creating the wholesome, in creating goodness. Okay. So it's a happy mind that takes delight in creating virtue, what we call merit. Yeah, merit basically means good karma. Okay, so it's a mental state. Yeah. So enlightenment will dwell in those who strive. Now the word strive, I don't know, the word strive in English, does that have a good connotation for you? Or what kind of connotation does strive have?
Continuous effort.
Continuous effort, okay. Okay, if you see, okay, good. Because if you see striving as continuous effort, it's that, if that's the connotation, that's the right meaning of the word strive. Yeah?
Maybe a different translation?
Yeah, you might. What does it say there?
Exert themselves.
It what?
Awakening will dwell only in those who exert themselves.
Okay, so exert themselves. I have it here. Yes, so as you can see, many different translations of the same thing. Yes, let me take it out here. Yes, because I have, you're using Stephen Batchelor's translation, and I'm using another translation that has the commentary in it. Okay, so here it says enthusiasm, doesn't it? Okay. For awakening will dwell only in those who exert themselves. So exertion or striving. Yeah, it has that meaning of continuous effort. What we want to not impute on the meaning of the word exert or strive is push. Okay? Because sometimes exert, you know, I got to really put, tomorrow's the exam and I have to really cram it in tonight and exert myself. Or sometimes striving, we impute on it the meaning of ambition. They're really striving to, be a big deal or something. So we don't want that, because pushing and joyous effort are not the same thing. And this is good that we clarify at the very beginning. So you can see by the definition of joyous effort, it's taking delight in virtue, in goodness. Does pushing take delight in goodness? No. Pushing is putting a whole expectation, a false expectation on our own head, and then making ourselves do something that has very little joy in it. Okay? So this is very important to understand, that a spiritual path is not about pushing ourselves and forcing ourselves and guilt-tripping ourselves and shoulding ourselves. Okay? I should. It's about changing our mind so that we really take delight in goodness, in virtue, in benefiting others, in wholesomeness. Okay? So it involves this process of mental transformation. Sometimes we need to nudge ourselves, okay? Not push ourselves, but nudge ourselves. Because sometimes our mind makes up other stories. Oh, I can't do this, it's too hard. If I do this, I'm not going to feel good. It makes up these kinds of stories that are actually unreasonable. When we see our minds doing that, then we have to nudge ourselves and say, but I can, and let's try. And it doesn't mean I have to be perfect, but let's do something. Okay? But nudging ourselves and encouraging ourselves in that way is very different than pushing ourselves. Okay? So just as there is no movement without wind, so merit does not occur without joyous effort. So of course, without wind, things don't move. Okay? So without some kind of joyous effort, our mind that is overcome by ignorance is not going to spontaneously create virtue and merit. We need to have this joyous effort that really inspires us. Okay? So they say that there's... So actually that's the first line in verse 2. What is enthusiasm? Yeah, it is finding joy in what is wholesome. Okay. Here it is enthusiasm about virtue. So they say that there's four types of joyous effort or enthusiasm. One is called armor-like joyous effort. The second, the joyous effort of application. The third, the joyous effort of non-discouragement and being unperturbed. And fourth, the joyous effort of non-complacency. Okay, if we continue in verse 2. Okay, one says its opposing factors are explained as laziness, attraction to what is bad, and despising oneself out of despondency. Here it says its discordant classes should be explained. They are laziness, adherence to what is negative, and despising oneself out of despondency. Okay. So, laziness. Actually, one way of defining laziness includes those other two, okay? Because sometimes when we talk about laziness, we say there's three kinds of laziness. Yeah, the laziness of just lying around, sleeping, lying around, doing nothing, what we commonly call laziness. And the second kind of laziness is, this is from another viewpoint, laziness is engaging in negative actions and being very, very busy with taking care of all of our attachments and following our wants and everything like that. And then the third kind of laziness is the laziness of discouragement. Okay, so here it says, laziness that adheres to the pleasures of indolence and physical and mental unserviceability. Okay, that's what we commonly call laziness. You want to sleep, you want to lie around, do nothing, right? Yeah. Then the second one is adherence to negative actions. One of my teachers said that the meaning of this is keeping ourselves as the busiest of the busy. Except we're busy doing things that are not very conducive for our spiritual practice. And then the third, the laziness of despising oneself, thinking, I cannot do this. It's interesting that despising ourselves, you know, self-loathing, low self-esteem, is considered a form of laziness. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, why? Well, because low self-esteem, we just say, I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm not capable of it. There's something wrong with me. I can't do it. And we give up on ourselves. Or another kind of it is not just discouragement about ourselves, but discouragement about the path. Path is just too hard. They expect me to do all that to become a Buddha? That is too hard. I cannot do that. Or we also get laziness, discouraged, or, you know, when we think about the result. Oh, full awakening, having omniscient mind, making manifestations in all the realms to benefit sentient beings. I can't become like that. I'm just little old me. Yeah, that result is too high. Okay, so the laziness, the self-discouragement can be either about ourselves, I'm incapable, the path to do it is too difficult, or the result is too high, I can never become like that. So it's what's very interesting about this kind of discouragement is that we put obstacles in our own path. Because what is discouragement? Discouragement is a bunch of thoughts. Who thinks those thoughts? Yeah. I tell myself it's impossible. I'm incapable. I can't do it. Yeah. So all of these kinds of thoughts from a Buddhist viewpoint are totally wrong thoughts. They have no basis in reality. Now, what's really interesting is one part of us goes, really? Really? You mean I have the potential to become fully awakened? That is great. Ah, there's some breathing space. And another part of us goes, no. Don't tell me I have that potential. I don't. I'm just incapable. Can't do it. Finished. Yeah. And there's some fear of somebody telling us that we have that potential, because if we have that potential, it means that we have to change and use that potential. And when we're down on ourselves, when we're depressed, we don't want to change. We want to sit there and stew in our depression and blame the whole world for it, or blame ourselves for it. In other words, not take any responsibility. So I'm not talking here about the kind of clinical depression that depends on brain chemistry. I'm talking here about our thoughts and the way we beat up on ourselves and all the kind of lies we tell ourselves. Remember last night I was talking about how we lie to ourselves? So all this discouraging self-talk, yeah, that does not come from our brain, and it doesn't come from outside. Yeah. And those thoughts, we're thinking them. And if we start analyzing them, we see that they're totally wrong thoughts. They're totally off the wall. Okay. But we'll get into that later. Okay. So, we've reached the end of this session. Let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.